Jewish audio on Chabad.org.
We are on Daf Yud Aleph, page 11, and somewhere, about halfway through the first page of Gemara. Now, the Gemara introduced this whole series, if you will, with a discussion about the word Vayihi. We talk about Vayihi, Lashon Tzar, and the Gemara did expound on the first word of Megillas Esther. But then after that, the Gemara started introducing preambles, various introductions to the lectures and sermons on Megillas Esther that were delivered in antiquity by the sages of the Talmud. And today, we are going to turn the corner, and the Gemara is going to actually return to expounding the Megillah itself. So we already talked about the word Vayihi, no reason to talk about that again. So what's the next word? Bimei. We talked about Bimei also. That was part of the drasha of Vayihi is Vayihi Bimei. According to some of the Mefarshim, there's a seeming redundancy over there. So at this point, the Gemara says, Achashverosh. That's where we start off. The word Achashverosh, that's the third word of the Megillah. Omar Rav. So Rav taught that the meaning of the word Achashverosh is conjunctive. It's a putting together of a number of different words, namely Achiv Shorosh, the brother of the head. The brother of the head. That's Achashverosh. In other words, there's no Aleph? Of course there is. Well, it's not going to have fully spelled Achashverosh with the Aleph in the, that's correct. However, the point that's being made is that Achashverosh is a conjunction of different words, and since it's a conjunction of words that are conflated together, the word Ach shows up there, and the word Rosh shows up there, albeit in shorthand, and it doesn't have an Aleph in between the Resh and the Shin, but nonetheless, that stands for Ach and Rosh, and he's Achiv Shorosh. So he's the brother of Head. And Uven Gilo Shorosh. Ben Gilo means he's a kindred spirit with Rosh. What does this mean? So obviously he's nobody's brother that's famous, and he's not a kindred spirit with just anybody. So Rashi tells us, Echav Shorosh means Kilomar Domelo. A brother means that one is like somebody else. That's why I use the English word kindred. The Marsha points out that brothers usually look alike. Sometimes you see two people, you say, are you guys brothers or something? Or we refer to people who have a similar approach to life or look alike, refer to them as brothers. Brothers in arms, brothers in struggles, brothers in troubles. You know, people talk about if they have a brother. So a brother, even in modern English, means somebody who shares your values, somebody who looks like you, somebody who acts like you. It's called a brother. So Achashverosh was like Rosh. He's very much like Rosh. And he was also Ben Gilo. He was also Ben Gilo means that Rashi says Ben Mazalo. He is literally the son of Mazal, which does not mean the son of any more than Bar Mitzvah doesn't mean the son of a mitzvah. It means one who is obligated in, one who is responsible, and therefore one who is connected to mitzvahs. So the idea then of Ben Gilo means that he is connected or linked to the Mazal. And Rashi interprets that to mean Shnehem Da'as Echos Hoyolahem. They both had the same bias or natural approach to life. They both looked at life in the same way. This all sounds really very mystical. And I think that before we proceed and find out who Mr. Rosh is, so you know who Achashverosh is, the brother of Rosh, the first thing that I want to tell you is when we analyze a name, we have this Torah belief that sometimes names can be meaningful, names can be indicative of something more than what simply meets the eye. There was a famous sage whose name was Rabbi Meir. And the Gemara tells us, Rabbi Meir, every time he would meet somebody, he would hear somebody's name, he would read into that. So nothing is by happenstance. We as Jewish people believe that when parents name a child, that there is actually a nevuah ktana, there's like a minor prophecy. And that ultimately, somehow, everybody ends up with a name that's rightfully theirs. And if you look into a name, it will be revealing. It will say something.
That's why they didn't change the name in case of...
There is also this idea of a change of name, correct? A change of name, its origins with the first Jews. Avraham and Sarah, whose names were changed by none other than God himself. And you remember that with Avram and Sarah, it's about mazel. There's a thing about mazel. Avram cannot have children. Sarai cannot have children. Avraham and Sarah is a change of mazel also. And interestingly, we talk about the idea of ben mazoli. Ben mazoli, that there's some kind of shared mazel, some kind of shared fortune or luck or predisposition, as we're going to see. So that's really the background that you have to appreciate and understand Rav's drasha from. And Rav doesn't explain that because he presumes you know that. The people he was talking to, they understood this, they knew this. He didn't have to tell them why I'm looking at a name or how a name can be conjunctive of a variety of different names. We have many things like this, by the way, in Jewish tradition, where there are conjunctive names which are not literal. We have Torah words which are to be understood conjunctively. For example, it says, V'hadarta pnei zakin, you should respect or give esteem to the face of an elder. And the tradition is that it's not talking about Zaken Ashmai necessarily, an elder who is only old because he's been around for a long time and his passport says 80 or 90 years ago. But rather, that it refers to Zeh Shekana Chachma. Now, where is the word Zeh? I see a Zion, that stands for Zeh. I see the word Kuf, which stands for Kana. But I don't see where it says Zeh Shekana Chachma. Well, it doesn't say Zeh Shekana Chachma. But this is what we call euphemism. Or sometimes we have a word which contains a variety of different allusions, and that's what the word is created from. A variety of different things. You're not going to see the actual word spelled out. That's an answer to your question. Or where's the Aleph and the Rosh? You're not going to see the word spelled out. The people who were learning with Rav understood this. He didn't have to explain that. He just said, Achashverosh. Ach, the brother of Rosh. Ben Gilo, others say he's the Ben Gilo of Rosh, a kindred spirit. It could have said a lot of things, but didn't say. It says Achashverosh, and therefore Rav.
No, if you read it through, it says Achshor, which means brother of an ox.
Okay, so here's the last little thing. We Torah Jews do not believe that the Bible is open for free interpretation, which means that anybody can read the words as he or she pleases, and everybody's opinion counts equally. No. We believe that if Rav read into the Megillah and saw the Megillah saying something, Rav, because of his great spiritual standing and his incredible intuition and his ability to have a near prophet-like understanding of Torah, when Rav looked at Achashverosh, he understood the deeper message. So it's valuable to continue to study the words of Rav some 1,700 years later. But me and you could play Scrabble and say, oh, it says Achshor, the brother of an ox. Ha! He was dumb as an ox. He's the brother of a pig. No, that doesn't work like that. Okay, now we got that cleared up. You can do whatever you want. Just don't call it Torah, and don't expect that anybody will be talking about it in 1,000 years from now, or maybe even in a year from now. Hit or miss is not a very good way to go through life. You know, you're a pharmacist. Tell me, if people take medicine, you say, you never know. Take it, whatever. There's a pill, I don't know, it's a white pill, a green pill. Take it, maybe you'll feel better. Don't tell me you advise your clients that way, because I'm not going to your pharmacy anywhere then. All right. So the question, of course, that we have to ask ourselves is, all right, I know Achashverosh, he's the brother of the head, he's the Ben Gilo. Pray tell, who is head? Who is that? Ah, who is that? Okay. So the Gemara says, Achiv Shel Rosh means, the meaning is that he is Achiv Shel Nebuchadnezzar. He's the brother of Nebuchadnezzar. This is the original Muslim Brotherhood. Okay, there's a bunch of people living in the Middle East, and they had a brotherhood, and they came together to do all kinds of nefarious things. That doesn't mean that they were blood brothers. It doesn't mean that they had any kind of genetic relationship. Ah, a fraternity. Shkoyach, I was looking for that word. How do we know that Nebuchadnezzar, Harasha, he's earned himself a special title in the Gemara? Doesn't that Nebuchadnezzar, Harasha, the wicked, evil Nebuchadnezzar, like Haman Harasha, Shenikra Roish, that he's called Roish, Shenemar, because it is written, Antu Reisha Di Dahava, you are the head of gold. What does this mean? Now this, in order to understand this, you need to look in the second chapter of the book of Daniel. And there's a prophetic image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream, a strange looking creature, maybe R2 from Star Wars or something. It looked like a very strange looking creature that he saw. And the strange looking creature was made of a variety of precious metals. There was a head of gold, there were arms of silver, and there were hips or legs of copper. And finally, the lower legs made of iron. That's the person that he saw.
R2D2.
That's what I said. So now what happens is that he comes to Daniel, who is a great prophet, and was actually appointed to very significant governmental positions of leadership and great responsibility in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, later to be demoted by Ahasuerus, by the way, to become the queen's press secretary. And that was his act of demotion, but that was a really good thing because, as a result, Esther had somebody she could trust, and when she needed to find out from Mordechai what was going wrong, she sent Hasach, who's really Daniel, and that's a story in and of itself. But getting back to Daniel, so Daniel was highly respected in the king's court, and he was appreciated as a person who could interpret the dreams and understand the deeper meaning of what happens. These levels of consciousness, messages that are being conveyed from a different place. So Daniel interprets the dream and he says, the gold head, that's you. That's you. That's what represents you. And the message, the metaphor being conveyed is that your dominion and your government will be very powerful, very strong, and will stand for a significant period of time, which it did, by the way. It did. Nebuchadnezzar later sinks, but not in the time of Nebuchadnezzar. His son Belshazzar, in his days, that's when the empire sinks. But in Nebuchadnezzar, there is a great deal of durability to his government and his empire. And the other various precious metals, or the hands, or the legs, and so on and so forth, that represent the subsequent malchiot, the subsequent empires that will rise afterwards. Okay, so we're talking here now about Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar's nam digur in Torah literature is Rosh, because that's how Hashem chose to portray him in his dream, interpreted by none other than Daniel himself, which is a part of the book of Daniel, a part of our eternal Torah. So, that's why he's called Achiv Shel Rosh, that he is the brother of Nebuchadnezzar. Ben Gilo Shel Rosh, I get this, you said that he is Achiv, he is like a brother of Nebuchadnezzar, but why did you call him Ben Gilo? Well, he's called Ben Gilo, my friends, the somebody who has the same mazel as Nebuchadnezzar. This is because Hu Harag, Nebuchadnezzar killed, massacred the Jews, and Hu Bikesh Laharig, and this Ahasuerus wanted to kill all of the Jews. And the Gemara says further, Hu Hecheriv, Nebuchadnezzar was actually responsible for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Hu Bikesh Lahachriv, he sought to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. How could he seek to destroy the Beis HaMikdash? The Beis HaMikdash had been destroyed 70 years before he rose to great prominence. Which Beis HaMikdash did he destroy? There was no Beis HaMikdash. Well, the Gemara says it is written, and the Gemara doesn't have to bring a pasuk for Nebuchadnezzar because everybody knows Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. That's common knowledge. But there was a Beis HaMikdash. Who destroyed the first Beis HaMikdash? Grade school children know the answer. Nebuchadnezzar or Russia. But why would you say that Ahasuerus actually wanted to destroy the Beis HaMikdash? Because it is written, "Ubemalchus Ahasuerus b'tchilasi," in the beginning of the Malchus of Ahasuerus. So this is a pasuk in Daniel. But Chilas Malchusei, as he just rose to prominence, Kasvu Sitna al Yeshve Yehuda v'Yerushalayim. Pardon me, this is a verse in Ezra, in the fourth chapter of Ezra, the sixth verse. It says that in the beginning of the days of Ahasuerus, they sent out a confounding decree from Ahasuerus. And what happened is that they actually did start to build the Beis HaMikdash. Darius the First ordained the permission for the Jewish people to start to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Ahasuerus stopped construction of the Beis HaMikdash. And by the way, construction was stalled for quite some time. It was only after Ahasuerus' death, where the next Darius ruled, who according to some opinions is actually the son of Esther. He was a Jewish boy who never reclaimed his legacy, who remained a Persian king. But this son of Esther, son of Ahasuerus, he was the one who finally allowed them to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. So you see that Ahasuerus does very similar things to Nebuchadnezzar. And the only difference sometimes between him and Nebuchadnezzar is Nebuchadnezzar did it and he wanted to do it. Well, you're going to say, so what if somebody wants to do it? He didn't do it. So the Sefer Chacham says a gewaldige thing. He says we have a tradition that when it comes to mitzvahs, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu considers HaKadosh Baruch Hu mitzarfa machashava lemaisa. That if somebody has a good thought, a good intention, really wants to do a mitzvah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you wanted to do the mitzvah? I consider it as if you did it. It's not like doing it, it's as if, ki'ilu, but still, Hashem gives a reward because you wanted to do it. You were prevented from outside sources. However, says the Sifrei Chachamim, we have a tradition that when it comes to the enemies of the Jewish people, it works in the exactly opposite fashion. When they wanted to do evil, Hashem considers it as if they did evil. So just as Hashem would consider your mitzvah, even if you didn't manage to do it, so too Hashem would consider the wicked persons, the enemies of the Am Yisrael, his Aveda, even though he didn't get to, he was confounded, he was impeded, so he doesn't really get credit. It's not like he decided not to do it. He wanted to do it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu considers it as if he would have done it. That's the drasha. Now, we haven't really explained the business of the mazel very well. What exactly does that mean? But so I'm going to come back to that. But first, I want to go through the Rashi's on Bikesh Lahachriv. He sought to destroy. What is that talking about? So Rashi explains a little bit more. He says, Yisoid Shiyisad Zerubbabel Beis HaMikdash. This is the foundations of the second Beis HaMikdash that were laid, albeit on the foundations of the first Beis HaMikdash, which was still extant. But we're not powerful and capable enough of holding a building. So Zerubbabel's time, they started to rebuild the foundations. So the foundations should be able to do this. Now this happened, my apologies, not in the days of Darius, in the days of Koresh. Of Koresh the king. This happened lefnei Achashverosh, before Achashverosh rises to power. K'misha Amar b'sefer Ezra, as it says in the fourth chapter of the book of Ezra. And Koresh allows them to start to do this, and Achashverosh puts the brake on. Because of Sitna. What is Sitna? Shenimna l'saten lahem shaloi yivnuhu. He decided to join those. He attached his royal seal and the power of his government to join those who sought to impede, to stop, to disable, to get in the way of the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Which, by the way, the word Satan, everybody's very familiar with that word, it's like an English word, Satan. What does it mean, Satan?
One who veers away from the root.
No, one who impedes. It says that when Bilam wanted to curse the Jewish people, and there was a malach, and the malach was there, l'satan loy, to satanize him. What does that mean? He was trying to save him. He wanted to do something good. Bilam was on a bad path. He tried to impede. He tried to be an obstacle on his path. So the satan is what comes to stop us from doing a mitzvah. We're committed. We're absolutely devoted. We want to do the mitzvah, and suddenly something gets in the way. So, the satan got in the way. Satan doesn't have to have red skin and horns and a tail and a pitchfork. The satan doesn't have to have wings. The satan doesn't have to have fangs. The satan means something that gets in the way. Similar to Yetzirah, but the Yetzirah is on a very personal level. And the satan could be things from outside of you. Yetzirah is the inclination of voice that's telling you, don't be silly, stay in bed, don't get up, don't do mitzvahs. That's the voice inside you. It says, close your hand, don't give the tzedakah, don't be kind, don't be observant. That's inside you. The satan is things which will stop you from the outside. Sometimes Hashem puts obstacles in our way, and that's to make us great. That's to make that occasion a memorable one. We want to do a mitzvah, and it was very, very hard. And we didn't get put off, and we didn't lose our stamina, and we continued to push forward, and that's a beautiful thing. And then later you remember it, and later you say, wow, that was an amazing mitzvah. Otherwise you wouldn't even remember it. But because the satan was there, the satan who tried to stop you actually enabled you to become much, much strong and profound. It's like a dam. The dam stops the water, but as a result of the water being stopped and held back, there's a much greater flow and force that ensues. So this is the idea of l'satan, and I want to go back to this business of the mazel. Now, the Maharsha says that ben mazoloi should not only be understood of deya achas. Deya means they have the same biases, they have the same predisposition. If a person, I think they know something. Maybe you learn something academically, you learn it. It's like, you know, you have something, you have a burst of inspiration, or, oh, I got that, okay, that's chachma. Like, you know, this bina is, I'm going to analyze it and look at it very deeply. But this remains very impersonal. I can be very cool, calm, and collected, and indifferent to it. It's just something I understand. But a deya, that's my opinion. So if I think, for example, that the yellow people are bad, my knee-jerk reaction to yellow people is, oh, the yellow people, they're doing something bad to me. It may not be correct. It doesn't matter if it's correct. That's my opinion. That's my bias. That's my predisposition. I start off to begin with, I'm here. Why are you there? I should be in the middle. No, I'm here. I know already. How do you know? Well, I have enough experience. I just know. And this is so Ahasuerus had the same predisposition. Nebuchadnezzar was predisposed to his bias, to his hatred, his anti-Semitism, and Ahasuerus is the same anti-Semite. Same anti-Semite. And don't think that the anti-Semites need excuses to be anti-Semites. The Jews misbehaved. Yeah, we have a lot of foolish Jews, that's true. A lot of Jews do a lot of very, very bad things which bring a bad reputation to us. But don't think that's why the anti-Semites hate us. Anti-Semites hate us because they want to hate us. You know, I talk to people sometimes about the situation in Israel. They say, we have terrible hasbara. It's because the Israelis didn't do good hasbara. They didn't explain it. You say, you're so wrong. You're so wrong. Could we have better hasbara? Sure, we could have. We could state our case better. But the truth is that the difference is so blatant. It's so obvious. It's so black and white. The fact that people could require hasbara is obscene. It's absurd. So the problem is everybody starts off here. Where do they start off? Israel is warlike. Jews are bad. They make trouble wherever they go. Okay. And then you say, so you have this person playing victim, even though he's the aggressor, and pointing, look, the Jew is the aggressor. And the person, oh yeah, right, of course the Jew. Jews are always the aggressors. So that's a bias. That's what we're dealing with. People don't even want to know who Ahasuerus is. The Gemara is telling us, here's a look into the twisted soul of this person. He was an anti-Semite. He was twisted with hatred. He was ugly, made ugly with his bias against the Jewish people. Just like his brother, his kindred spirit, Nebuchadnezzar. Now the Marsha says something fascinating. We have a Gemara in Shabbos. The Gemara near the end of the last chapter in Kuftan Vav. And the Gemara over there talks about, in Perek Mishahechshir, the Gemara talks about different signs of the zodiac and the different orbs. And in Talmudic literature, we find Mercury, Venus, Mars, Saturn, and Jupiter, and the moon. These are the different bodies of heaven, different orbs we talked about. And it says that the different orbs and different planets, they correspond to different times. And that time is divided up, that these seven orbs are divided up within the hours, 12 hours of the day and night. And it's a repetitive system, which is jagged, of course. And every single hour has a mazel. Every hour has a mazel. A mazel means like there's a malach, there's an angelic force or power that's activated. Think of time as a reality, not something that passed by. Think of time as a frame. So this frame in time, whatever happened in this frame of time, was governed by a certain divine animating force. And that animating force in the next frame of time is the next frame. And before God, the past and the present and the future is all the same. It's only us who have to live within the vicissitudes of time, and we can only live in the now, in this present frame, and the other frames were, and then there are frames to come. But for Hashem, every frame is a frame in time. It's frozen. We can't understand that. It's not possible for the human mind to fathom that. Now, because each frame is a reality, it's created by Hashem, it needs to have an animated divine force. And that divine force that animates it is called a mazel. Hence the concept of mazel tov. We say mazel tov. Oh, this should be a good auspicious hour. This should be a favorable divine energy for you. Now, those who worship the mazalot are fools. It's like praising the pen or the typewriter of the writer. Or praising the brush of the artist. You think it's Picasso had a magic brush? No, Picasso was an amazing creative artist. They may pay $10,000 for the brush, and that's another story. But if they're foolish enough to think that if you hold that brush, you'll be able to paint too, then you're a big fool. That is the source at its very, very simple level of idolatry. Where the people said, Oh, heavenly bodies. God made this animating force that's now enabling us to exist. We must worship it. So you worship Kechav Memazolus. You're worshiping, like it says in the Gemara, Kegarzen B'Adachaitzim. You're worshiping the hatchet instead of the hand that's chopping. The hatchet did it. The hatchet didn't do anything. Now, but this animating force is a reality. There are sharp knives and dull knives. So if the person who's a very, very good a chef and knows how to chop up, you know, like doing those shows, chop up the cucumber in like 4.5 seconds. Whether you throw a tomato in, they're going to go like this, right? If you have a sharp knife, it's going to be a little more effective. If you have a dull knife, you can't go so fast, go back and forth. Okay, so it's good to have, so there's sharper knives and duller knives. There are more mazeldika hours or less mazeldika hours. That's called, in Yiddish, say a mazeldika shah. Mazeldik means it's auspicious, it's propitious, it's there's a sharp knife around. You know, if only we can harness this energy, good things can happen. And this is also the idea of, on a birthday, we say mazal lo gover, because in that hour, whenever you were born, whenever your birthday comes around, which is you come around the cycle of life, when you come back to your birthday, the hour that actually helped you get down the birthing canal and got in and gave you the miracle of life, the gift of life, that mazal is yours. And that's why we say that there's this concept of mazal lo gover, that a person's birthday, they have extra special power. They're linked into a special iCloud to that moment in the past. That first divine animating force that gave, that enabled them to have the gift of life from Hashem, is available once again to you. This is the business of mazal. Now, the Gemara also says in Brachas, the Gemara starts to discuss that being born under the influence of a particular mazal may have an impact on your predisposition. And for example, it says the person who's born under the mazal of the sun will be naturally able to give. He'll be a benefactor. And he'll be able to share light. Okay, sun. And the moon is the moon-like things. And the Gemara goes through all the things. And it goes through Saturn. As Saturn is ominous. And Jupiter is righteous. It means tzedek in Hebrew. Right? And then we come to Mars. Mars is the last thing. And Mars is called Ma'adim, the red planet. And the Gemara identifies the red planet as being connected to... If you say red, what with the color red? What's the first blood? Exactly. So it's called dam. So therefore, mazal maidim, the Gemara over there says that a person who's born in mazal maidim will have a predisposition to bloodletting. That doesn't mean murder. He could be a doctor. He could be a mohel. He could be a shochet. It could be a lot of things. This, the Gemara over there asks, Rabbah asks a question. Rabbah says that, but I was born a mazal maidim. And he said, I don't do any of those things. So interestingly, the response is, yes, but you're a judge. And the judge sometimes has to convict. So it doesn't have to be literal. Sometimes it could be figurative. But the point is bloodletting, or the power of life and death in hands. So does this mean somebody is predisposed to be bad? Of course not. But we are all predisposed to certain things. Some of us are more intelligent, and some of us are less intelligent. Are you predisposed to success in academia if you're more intelligent? Of course you are. That's ridiculous, Ami. What are you talking about? If you're a dumb person, then you have a hard time learning. If you're a smart person, you'll have an easier time learning. And the truth is, yeah, I know the mushel. I know the famous parable of the hare and the tortoise. But let me tell you something. The only reason that the tortoise got there first was because the hare was a lazy bum. But if the hare would just keep moving, he would be miles ahead of the tortoise. The tortoise would never catch up to him. And they used to say, very good. They used to say in the Lita, in Lithuania, they used to say they very valued learning. That was the only currency in Lithuania was academia, learning. So in the Lita, they used to say like this. Es ist besser zu haben a gute hinten, da a gute Kopf. It's better to have a good backside than to have a good brain. A backside is a metaphor for this, like you say in English, they say sit and learn. It's diligence. Diligence. Yes, diligence. And they would say one of the great Rosh Yeshiva, Chaim Brisker, said, he said, what's the difference between a better head and a worse head? So what's the difference? He said, 2 centimeters of wax. You're sitting and studying the night, so the smart guy gets it faster. And the one who's not as wise, it takes him another day. The wax has to burn a little longer. It's all fine, true, and good. Well, if you could have a gute hinten und a gute cup, what if you could have a good backside, meaning you have patience and diligence, and you're smart? Obviously, that's a predisposition. So nobody could say that nobody's predisposed. There are people who are predisposed to be dynamic. There are people who are predisposed to be absolutely boring. There are people who are predisposed to excel in logistics. There are people who are predisposed to excel in being the service industry. They're just happy to serve, and they don't care. They'll take any kind of punishment, and they don't mind. Their dignity is not an issue. And other people have a predisposed that they can't be in the service industry. They can't stand being abused by people. They want to be calling the agenda and the shots. They're all different personalities. So really, this is what the Gemara is telling us. There are different personalities, and that has something to do with the energy that spirits you into this world. Why am I sharing this with you? It's nothing to do with the Gemara in Megillah. But it really does, because the Marsha, you know, with the highest esteem for Rashi, he says, yes. Shneim dea achas, he says. But Marsha says, I do believe that there is more. It's simply an issue of dea achas. It's not just that they were of similar bias, but rather they were actually of kindred predisposition. That both of them were born in a way that they were prone towards bloodletting. And since they were not people who became a mohel and a shochet, and since they were people who became emperors, and not just any kind of emperors, but dominant, powerful emperors, and nobody becomes a dominant, powerful emperor without stepping over a lot of dead bodies. That's the way it is. So these are people who were violent. Violent. Violent individuals. Bloody individuals. Murderous individuals. Now you know who we're talking about. So what's so fascinating about this? I think what's so fascinating is that just from the name Achashverosh, we have a window into this guy's twisted soul. We know A, we know that he's an anti-Semite, a hater of Jews. B, we know he's a violent person, a cruel person. All right. So now that we know a little bit about Achashverosh, the Gemara goes on and says like this. That was just Rav's opinion. That's what Rav said. V'Shmuel Amar, and Shmuel said, he's called Achashverosh, not so much because of his predisposition, biases, and natural being prone naturally to violence. But Shmuel says Achashverosh is Shehushcheru Pneim Shel Yisrael B'Yomov, because the Jewish people's faces were quote-unquote blackened. Blackened by soot, kishulik deira, like the bottom of a nice clean pot that goes onto a fire. And after some time, when it sits upon the fire, it becomes blackened with soot because of the fire that's burning. The Jewish people, in other words, were severely impacted by his dominion. This does not have to mean that they were necessarily beaten. This does not even have to mean that they were necessarily being slated for genocide in the days of Achashverosh. It means that they were blackened because of his leadership. I don't think it means hatred. I think this may mean blackened spiritually. It's nothing to do, by the way, with black or white. It's just a euphemism. It's a metaphor. But I think it means that Achashverosh's friendship to the Jewish people was extremely damaging to them. They paid dearly for the friendship of having them invited to the palace where Achashverosh is prancing around wearing the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, serving on sacred vessels from the Beis HaMikdash, making a mockery of everything that we believed was good and holy. And Achashverosh was laughing in their faces, but he was very friendly to them. I love Jews, he said. Jews are great. Jews are fantastic. Reminds me of certain politicians who have done more damage to the Jewish people with a smile. They call it a killer assassin, the assassin with a smile. With the smile, more damage even than the person who overtly and outwardly hates you. Because at least you know where the other guy is standing. You know, Achashverosh made like he's a friend. And I would give you an example in history. Napoleon Bonaparte was a very evil person. And even though he talked about emancipation, and even though he talked about freedom, if you go deeper into his writings and into the things he did, he had an unbelievable hatred for Judaism. And he wanted to subjugate Judaism. He even printed a coin, he minted a coin that showed Moses bowing down to Napoleon. And one of the things he wanted to do was reinstate the Sanhedrin. Now I ask you, why does a French king need to reinstate Sanhedrin? Very simple. He could legislate Judaism out of business with Judaism itself. And the Alter Rebbe had a very, very big argument with some of his peers. They felt that if Napoleon would be victorious over the Tsar, the lot of the Jewish people would improve. And the Alter Rebbe said the lot will improve materially, but it will be a disaster spiritually. And therefore the Alter Rebbe did whatever he could, including sending one of his most trusted chassidim to go and join the war effort. And he became a spy. His name was Moshe Meislish, as to the grandfather of our Ami. Ami is Ben Achaben for Rabbi Shem Meislish. Many, you're Ben Achaben. That's not a small thing. It's a big yichus. And when his family moved from Lithuania to Hungary, he went from Meislish to Meislish. That's a big thing. It's a very big thing.
But he ended up in Hebron.
Yes. He did go to Eretz Yisrael later. Anyway, but that's not the point. The point is that the Alter Rebbe felt so strongly about this that he literally risked the lives of his chassidim to help the Tsar win. Do you know who the Tsar was? A subhuman, a brutal monster, a person who had no problem killing his way through anything that he wanted, and their anti-Semitism is the stuff that horror stories and nightmares are made of, and yet the Alter Rebbe said we would suffer, but Judaism would not be as hurt. So I'm just a little guy. What do I know? But it seems to me, from my understanding of the Gemara and of the Maharsha explains it, seems to me that the real issue here was the hushchru means we were blackened by the soot by the tepid love of Ahasuerus, by his embrace of us, we see that this became the most damaging thing of all. I mean, the truth is, it shouldn't really be such a chiddush. The reality is that as a result of that mass assimilation, what do we end up with? We ended up with the Gzeirah of Haman, plain and simple. Under whose watch? Ahasuerus's watch. So according to Shmuel, the name Ahasuerus is less about who this man was by his personality, a character, but more about who this man, what this man accomplished, what he did, is the really dangerous enemy. The enemy who appears to be not a foe, but a friend. Most dangerous of all. Most dangerous of all. Huh? Yes. Certain very prominent politicians who I think of when I read this. Okay. Rabbi Yochanan Omar. Now we have Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was the elder of the two, Rav and Shmuel. Really, they're all similar friends. They all the contemporaries studying together at the very end of the Mishnaic period. Rabbi Yochanan remains in Eretz Yisrael. Rav and Shmuel go off to Bavel. But they all study together in the longer shadow of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's yeshiva. Rabbi Yochanan says like this: Kol shezoichrei, anybody who would mention his name, just the mention of a name, Omar, he would say, Ach l'reishi. Now, Ach is the, maybe like the Byzantine era term for Oi in Marhan Yiddish. People still say, Ach, Ach l'reishi. This guy is a headache. This is the kindness. So what, in other words, that Ahasuerus was a person who gave in people a very, very hard time thinking of him, just gave people a headache. And the Maharsha says, the people were krechtzing all day under Ahasuerus, saying, oi, so much so that actually it negatively impacted them. And in fact, the Maharsha says that the other interpretation could be that och is like David HaMelech says in Tillim, ha-och, ha-och, means like laughing or cursing, like mocking. He said the people would say, och l'reishe, as if they were cursing their own heads, another way is they were cursing Ahasuerus. Ach l'roishoy, may a pak strike him. Like, ach l'roishoy, a curse on his head for what he's doing to us. Now, what does this tell us? This tells us Ahasuerus was not a very popular fellow. He was a hated man. He didn't have star power. Well, why did everybody allow him to be king? He didn't have a choice. Because he was a brutal monarch. Because it was either you wanted to keep your head on your shoulders, you said, yes, sir. And he brutally repressed the people. You'd never know that. You read the Megillah, he seems like a nice guy. He built sofas and couches and wines and does all he's entertaining everybody. That was all in order to create a popularity amongst the clerisy, the leading elements of society, but ultimately he brutally repressed any kind of opposition. And that was how he remained in power. It sounds like a lot of things. But really, seriously, it's amazing how just the name Ahasuerus tells us a great deal. The sages looked at this name and they were able to read it and understand it. Rabbi Chanina says, you know what else it means? Shahakol nasa roshan biyomav. Everybody came impoverished during his days. In other words, that everybody essentially became poor as a result of taxation. Shenemar, as it says, Vayosim hamelech Ahasuerus mas. Mas, the king levied a tax. Now, so what? Every king levies a tax. Says the Siv Sechem, exactly. Every king levies a tax. You don't have to say the king levied a tax. That's the nature. You know, taxes and death, the two things which are always going to be certain. Every government is going to tax. How else will a government be able to live? But over here, the Megillah tells us Ahasuerus levied a tax. If you have to tell us that he levied a tax, what does that tell you? It tells you that when it came to taxes, Ahasuerus was in the highest bracket. He levied a tax. He didn't just do taxes. He taxed you to death. No, it's okay. So we're talking about big government, and we're talking about suffocating the environment, and we're talking about nobody prospered under Ahasuerus. Not that people were like a king. He doesn't have star power. He's not a friendly guy, but everybody's prospering at least. Says Rabbi Chanina, not so that this guy. And in fact, the Maharsha says they were screaming, ugh! Ach from this guy, look at us, ach rush, not reish, but ach rush. Rush in Hebrew means to be impoverished. Ach, our economy is in shambles. Ach, nobody's doing well. Sounds familiar? The people say when the economy's bad, right? And by the way, this also explains to you how it was so easy for Haman to write his Achashverosh sanction decree against the Jewish people. Because when the economy is bad, what does everybody look for? A scapegoat. And who is the world's most natural scapegoat, unfortunately? Us. Historically, whenever there was a need for a scapegoat, unfortunately, we got volunteered. So now you understand what's going on over here. The people were living under a king who was despotic, a man who was violent, a man who was crude, a man who was an anti-Semite. The people were living under an individual who not only was all of those things, but also the kind of person who very, very seditiously undermined you. He undermined from underneath, and he undermined the position of the Jewish people without them even realizing it. Very, very sly, very clever. So he undermined the Jewish people's position. Besides this, Achashverosh is the kind of person who everybody was unhappy but terrified of. And they have a bad economy, and they have a day to get crazy and kill the Jews. No. Where's this going to go? Nobody had any doubt where this was going to go. And actually, if not for the miracle of Purim, it's too scary to think where it would have gone. We wouldn't be here today. And that, of course, is why we celebrate Purim. So, the Gemara now begins to talk about the fact that the first of the words, Vayihi, we expounded. Bimei, we expounded. Whole list of preambles of the Gemara. Then what happened? Achashverosh. We got five opinions what the meaning of the word Achashverosh. How does the Megillah go? Vayihi, Bimei, Achashverosh. Hu Achashverosh. So now we go to the next two words in the Megillah. Hu Achashverosh. What is Hu Achashverosh? Says the Gemara. The Gemara continues now to analyze the next two words. Why does it say Hu Achashverosh? What is the message for us? Says the Gemara. Hu Achashverosh means Hu Berishoi Mitchilosei Vad Soifoi. He remained wicked from the beginning until the end. In other words, that the word who means he is. Who is he? Who is he? This is who he is. I don't understand. It's not so much literal. This is more a level of dash. It's a who is he? Who is he? Who? Who is he? Everybody knows who he is. As they say, people don't change. Who is he? He is. This is who he is. So why did he do this to me? Why did that happen? That's who he is. What did you expect was going to happen? Guy's a ganef. Why did he steal from him? Because that's who he is. The guy's a backstabber. What? But that's who he is. So who means...
His character definition.
And I know, and it's not just like a play on words from who to who, but like the point is, who means he is. And just in English happens to be interesting. Who is also like, who is more the question, is the answer the same? All right. So the idea of who means that he was there without any kind of interruption the whole time. He was always wicked. That's the bottom line. Who... He was Berishoi Mitchilosei V'ad Seifei. The Torah Tmima says that it's not just that he was, but that he clung to his wicked ways. He didn't deviate. He didn't have a nice day, a good day, a friendly day. He stayed like that. He continued to be like that all the time. How does that work? What is the meaning of Achashverosh's wicked from the beginning until the end? Well, the first thing we know about Achashverosh is not about his birth. We don't know really about his childhood. There is different opinions whether he was the son of a king, son of Darius, which is of the Mede, Daryavash HaModai, which is the opinion of the Targum Sheni in the Megillah. But most of the other Chazals seem to indicate that he was a stable boy, coming from a very, very low background, with ruthless, with unbelievable, powerful ambition. And he rose to great prominence. So what's the first time we hear of him? When he manages to usurp the throne. He marries his trophy bride, granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. She's his ticket to royalty. Then he makes sure to kill her. But first he usurps the throne. And when he assumes the throne, what's the first thing we read about? The first thing we read about is his stopping of the Beis HaMikdash. He stops construction. Messengers come from Yerushalayim. They slander the Jewish people. Mordechai tries to intervene, by the way. It doesn't help. Bottom line, slanders the Jewish people, accepts the slander, and... no Beis HaMikdash. So, who B'tchilas Avat Sefer means, not from his birth, but here it would mean from his career. His beginning of his career, the first major thing he did was shut down construction on our Holy Temple. And what's the last thing we read about in his career? The end of the story, of the Megillah. What's that? The story of the Megillah. It's the story of Haman. So Marsha says, that's your beginning and that's your end. However, the Ion Yaakov suggests it begins with the Beis HaMikdash and it ends with the Beis HaMikdash. Because guess what? Achashverosh appointed Mordechai as prime minister, and the Jewish people all of a sudden were popular again, if not loved, at least respected and held in esteem. Funny thing happens though. The Beis HaMikdash never gets built. It doesn't get built until after he's dead. Only the next king, Darius, allows for the building. So the Ion Yaakov says, he stops the Beis HaMikdash and he continues to stop the Beis HaMikdash. And here's something very interesting. The Gemara, in a few pages, is going to talk about Esther's conversation when she is with Achashverosh. And Achashverosh says, what would you like, my beloved Queen Esther? Ad chatzi hamalchus. I'll give you half the kingdom. Wow, what a generous guy.
Only half.
She says, no, come back tomorrow for dinner. And then he says again, my beloved, what would you like? Ad chatzi hamalchus. Now, this, of course, obviously it's euphemism. It's just like it's expression. However, the Gemara says that the word chatzi is connected to the word chotzetz. Chotzetz means to make an interruption. A simple example. There's something called a chatzitza. So when you go to mikveh, for example, a proper immersion in the mikveh means you have to be fully immersed. So if there's going to be some kind of dirt or foreign substance attached to your body, that's a problem with going to the mikveh. Why? Because it separates you from the waters of the mikveh. Another example, there's a discussion about how long a yid's hair can be before it starts to get in the way of the tefillin. And the hair can be a chatzitza. Person has one of these massive afros, it can actually be a chatzitza. Why? Because you have 6 inches of hair, could be an interruption. That's why traditionally Jews have always had short haircuts, because you have to wear tefillin. So you have to wear, you have to make sure your haircuts are no chatzitza. So this business, that's called another example of chatzitza. What does chatzitza mean then? Chatzitza means something which serves as a barrier or separation. So the Gemara says, Achashverosh said like this, Ad chatzi amalchus means as long as it doesn't get in the way of my being king. As long as it doesn't in some way diminish my power, my monarchy, my dictatorship, if you will, that's fine. Ad chatzi amalchus, till you get in the way of my governance. You want gold, you want silver, whatever you want. No problem, Esther, whatever you want. But, here's what's off limits. Hamalchus, that's off limits to you. That's off limits. And Achashverosh, the Gemara says, felt that the building of the Beis HaMikdash would be, in some way, a challenge to his dominion. Because Achashverosh was such a narcissist, he wanted the whole world to talk only about Achashverosh. And only Achashverosh's palace should be the wonder of the world. But if there's going to be a temple which becomes a source of inspiration and spirituality for all peoples, because that's what the Beis HaMikdash actually was, and is supposed to be, Achashverosh felt competition. He said, that gets in my way. So if that's going to get in my way of my malchus, he said, Mordechai, you can be prime minister, Jewish people, you can live comfortably, you can do business, you'll be fine, honored Persian citizens. Remember, Shushan is the center of the universe, not Jerusalem. So as long as it didn't get in the way of his malchus, no problem. And that narcissism is what characterizes Achashverosh from the beginning till the end. He only has one question when a situation faces him. What's in it for me? What does it mean to me? It's all about me. Everything revolves around me. I am the center of the universe. And in my geocentric, narcissistic reality, it all has to fit for me. And that's who Achashverosh was. And he was always like that. Mitchilasei v'atseifei, from the beginning till the end. The Gemara now tells us another few people who are like that. The Gemara introduces us to a collection of the world's greatest narcissists. Who Esav? Who Esav? It says who? Who Esav? Who Esav means who Berishai. He and his wickedness, mitchilasei, from the beginning until the very end. Now the Gemara doesn't really explain what this means. The Gemara doesn't say, what does it mean that Esav was wicked from the beginning till the end? So the Marsha says, well, the first time we get introduced to Esav, when he becomes really an independent individual, is when he's 15 years old. It was the day of Avram Avinu's funeral, and Esav was busy. He couldn't attend the funeral. It was a great day for him to commit his first murder. So Avram Avinu never saw or found out in his terrestrial lifetime that his own grandson became a murderer. He killed Nimrod that day. And then he came home and he was exhausted from the fact that he had just killed somebody. He wasn't used to killing yet. It was still drained him. And he felt he was exhausted and collapsing. And he said to Yaakov, give me some of the porridge, which Yaakov was making as Sudas Havara. He was cooking a meal, a comforting meal for his father. So Yaakov Avinu says, what do you mean? I can't give you. This is for dad. Esau said, give me what I want. Esau, Yaakov says, okay, give me a b'chayra. You're not worthy of this. Esau says, no problem. He says, Vayizav Esau as b'chayra. He scorned the rights to be the one to represent the Jewish people before Hashem. He laughed and mocked it. That was a wicked thing to do. So that's the beginning of Esau, where Esau is an Esau. We see who Esau is. And what was the end? The end is, the last day of Esau's life, he's making trouble. On the last day of Esau's life, he came to Yaakov's burial to stop them from bringing Yaakov's coffin or body into Ma'arat HaMachpelah. And in the end, he refused to let them in. And they said, what do you mean? We had a deal. Yaakov paid you an enormous amount of money, paid you off to buy your portion. He says, nope, he got half, I got half, he put his wife there, I go in there now. In the meantime, we had done. It was the fast runner. It was like the gazelle. He started running back to Mitzrayim to get the actual piece of paper. Nobody ever thought of bringing the deed along. And there was a deaf grandson. His name was Chushim. And he didn't know who this guy is, this wild, crazy man, standing there blocking. All he knew was he couldn't, those days there was no sign language. He didn't have all the fancy technology we have today and all the advanced methodology of dealing with a deaf person. He didn't know what was going on. He couldn't figure it out. Nobody could explain it to him. All he knew, somebody was stopping his beloved grandfather from getting buried. So he took care of the problem. He took a sword and that was it. He removed Esau's head from the rest of his torso. The story goes that the head rolls in and the head of Esau is in Ma'arat HaMachpelah, but the rest of his body was carried away by his family. And this is a whole story in and of itself. But bottom line, Esau was a lying, cheating narcissist till the last day of his life. Now this is really interesting, that the Marsha, when he wants to talk about Esau, he doesn't start talking about Esau's birth. He doesn't talk about Esau's gestation. He talks about Esau when he's 15 years old. And indeed, that is a reasonable approach because the Chumash itself says, Vayigdlu ha'na'arim, when they grew up, when they came into their own. That's when you began to see the difference between a Yaakov and an Esau. Interestingly, it is scientifically proven that the genetic predisposition will not necessarily begin to surface until adolescence. For example, in a home where learning is valued, even children who are genetically not very intelligent will do well in school. Because learning is valued. It's all about conditioning. It's all about nurturing. In a home where learning is not valued as much, but the kids come from very smart parents, they maybe won't do so well in school. But in high school, everything changes. When they reach adolescence, everything changes. The brilliant kids automatically become the brilliant kids. And the kids who are not so brilliant becomes very, very apparent. So kids are kids. Kids are usually kids. But where do you start to see the real strong dominant strains of genetic predisposition? You start to see that really in adolescence. That's when people start really developing. And this is how it was with Esau. It says, Vayigdlu ha'na'arim. When they were children, whatever, they're children. But they grew up. And then Esau went off his way. And Yaakov went off his way. So that makes sense to say. And such thing as a child is wicked. The child doesn't have had the freedom to choose. The Eon Yaakov, however, says, what? He says, I don't understand what the Marshal is talking about. He says, Esau was wicked from the womb. It says that Esau, when he was still in vitro, he was still a fetus, he was looking to go out to do all kinds of bad things. As Rashi tells us in the Chumash, that it says, Vayisroitzitzu Abanim, the children were fighting inside there. What does this mean? So Rashi says that our sages said this was the Lashon Ritza. He was rushing, he was looking. When she would walk by, when Rivka would walk by, the pregnant mother would walk by Pischei Torah, the place where Shem Ve'Aver were teaching about monotheism and Torah and spirituality, Yaakov would get all excited. And then when she would go by a base Evdei Avedezara, a house of idolatry and ill repute and lack of holiness and spirituality and morality, Esav got really excited. And she said, Ve Yizmir, right? So there's a whole business over here. And she went to seek out this advice from a higher place. And she goes to Shem. And she says, what's going on? And he says, oh, Shnei Goyim Bevitnech, Shnei Le'umim, Imayach Yiporeidu. There's a very colorful life that's going to be unfolded here. So the Rebbe asks a question. Gevald, Gevald, he says. Esav had no chance. He had no chance. He was a baby. And already Esav wants to do bad things. It says it right there. So the Rebbe explains this, by invoking a beautiful principle which is articulated by the Rambam in his Shmoneh Prakim, which is his introduction to Pirkei Avos. He talks about ethos, and he talks about ethical behavior, and he talks about people rising to excellence behaviorally, developing properly as mensch. Turn it on mensch. So the Rambam over there says, he coins two phrases. He says that there's two ways in serving Hashem. One is a chassid hama'ula, the person who's pious, who naturally gravitates towards doing what's right and what's good. And he only wants holiness. That's all he's interested in. That's the only thing that captures his attention. But then we have, he says, a different kind of person. He's called HaKoyvish HaSyitzri, the one who dominates his Yetzirah, who overpowers his Yetzirah. He has lots of desires, unhealthy, unwholesome, unholy desires, but he overcomes those desires. And the Rambam says each has a virtue. The Chassid HaMa'ula, he's a perfect Chassid. He's very pious. It resonates with him. He's a natural. And that's really nice. He has no connection to evil. He doesn't have to overcome evil. But the Rambam goes on to say that the truth is, that the Kavish HaSyitzri, that's where true greatness is to be found. Because he has to work for it. He has to really, really find the stamina and the courage to overcome the Yetzirah. He has to be able to serve Hashem with great determination. And that determines his spiritual status. So the Rebbe says, we could say the same thing about Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov and Esav were predisposed to different methods in Avodas Hashem, to different approach to Avodas Hashem. Very different. The question was, who would rise to the greatest prominence? That was the question. And the answer is that ultimately it is Yaakov, not Esav, who succeeded. But really, Esav could have succeeded too. Esav could have been more successful, a bigger Oved Hashem. And that's why Yitzchak kept trying to get through to Esav. Because Yitzchak understood the profound spirituality that was Esav's, if only he would claim it. Rivka was pragmatic. She knew it would never happen. Now this gives us a window into Yaakov and Esav as small children, not as wicked and as good, which this very much would bolster the opinion of the Maharsha. On the surface, the Ian Yaakov seems right. Esav says he was wicked from the first second, and Yaakov was good to the first second. But the truth is that you can't say that. So Rishos, evil, has to come at a certain point, and because they have this idea of Rishos, it comes only at a certain point, that's why the Maharsha will tell you, that means Mitchilas Yivat Sefer, that's the meaning of from the very beginning until the very end. Let's just quickly finish off this piece of Gemara. Who Dasan Vavidam? This is Dasan Vavidam. Who is Dasan Vavidam? The people who challenge Moshe Rabbeinu. Hein Berishu Mitchilason V'at Sefer, from the beginning. When do we get introduced to Dasan and Vavidam? The day after Moshe Rabbeinu slays the Egyptian. And Dasan and Avinam all of a sudden are coming and they're making out, they're fighting with each other. And Moshe Rabbeinu screams, Lama Sakar Eyecha. Right? So that's Dasan and Avinam. Aha, that's Dasan and Avinam. So that's the beginning. And what's the end of Dasan and Avinam? The end of Dasan and Avinam, says the Marsha, is when they get swallowed up in a hole with Korach, leading a rebellion against Moshe. So from the very beginning of Dasan and Avinam until the very end, and we know that they made trouble all along. And so also it says, Hu HaMelech Achaz, that the Melech Achaz was Berishoi, Mitchilosei V'ad Seifoi, that Achaz was a wicked king from the very beginning until the very end, as it says in the book of Chronicles, in the book of Divrei Yomim, that it says over there, there's a pasuk that says, Ube'eis HaTzarloi V'yosef Limelboi. What does V'yosef mean? V'yosef means he added, he assaulted, so to speak, holiness even more. He did even, V'yosef means it was always like that, says Marsha, and now he became even more profoundly wicked. And this shows you how he was wicked from the very beginning until the very end. By the way, in the Medrash, there is also a drasha on Nimrod. But the Gemara doesn't include Nimrod. And I don't know with certainty why. But I would say that the Gemara talks about this is all part of a Jewish story. Nimrod's challenge against Avram Avinu was against a Jew. Avram is the first Hebrew, the first Yid, but not the challenge against the Jewish people. Achaz is a king, a Jewish king, unfortunately, but goes against the Jewish people. Esav is against the Jewish people. What's it called? Dasan Avinam? It's against the Jewish people. All these people, except for the Achashverosh, they're all actually Jewish. They're all actually Jewish. And maybe that tells us that Achashverosh had potential to do something to be very good. He could actually have been a good person, which makes him that much more wicked. The one who's capable of doing good that becomes evil is even more guilty. And that's what we talk about. The Nimrod. Nimrod's a troublesome figure from a different era. For whatever reason, the Gemara chooses not to bring his Nimrod. And what do we get from this? The word, we said, we now know was Vayibi Mei. We know what the word Achashverosh is, and we now know also what it means, Hu Achashverosh. So we know Achashverosh was rotten, wicked, and sordid from the very beginning of his career until the very end. Don't have these nice, rosy, dreamlike images of Achashverosh being a benevolent king or a fool who didn't know what was going on, and Haman just took advantage. Think again, say our sages. That's not what the Megillah tells us.
It's quite different from the common thought of Achashverosh.
It is, you are right. The common thought of Achashverosh is that he was just a fool. And that is simply wrong. And that's exactly why the sages of our sages came and said, let's learn the Megillah together, my friends. Let's find out what really happened.